the debate over U.S. foreign aid as most assistance remains frozen.
They have the right to review funding and how those decisions are made and what priorities are being funded. I think that's probably true of any administration when they come in.
What's been the thinking behind U.S. foreign aid?
It is the overall impression that the United States creates around the world by the sum total of its assistance programs, its military partnerships, its behavior on the world stage, its dependability in crises for countries that might need our help. It's the basic image of the country.
Today is Thursday, February 6th, and this is The Issue from VOA.
I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London.
Today I'll sign a waiver of our programs, our foreign aid programs that work in conjunction with our partners here that have been successful, so those successes can continue. And we're going to look for opportunities to expand upon those programs by making available new technologies that will allow them to even be more effective in stopping these drugs. This is an example of the kinds of programs that make America safer and stronger.
U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio in the Dominican Republic talking about funding a foreign aid program that the Trump administration thinks puts America first, the new overall policy driving U.S. diplomacy. There has been vigorous debate in the past few weeks as the Trump administration paused most foreign assistance while it evaluates where the dollars are going.
Congressional Democratic leadership warned President Donald Trump this week they will use upcoming government funding talks as leverage to fight the administration's changes to the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is often referred to as USAID, the nation's leading provider of humanitarian aid overseas. VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson, has more.
From protecting Amazon rainforests to caring for Myanmar refugees and housing Ukrainians fleeing the war against Russia, the absence of U.S. assistance is being felt around the world. In Washington this week, Democratic lawmakers protested outside the now closed headquarters of the lead U.S. aid agency and outside the U.S. Capitol. Cory Booker is a Democratic senator.
Violations of separation of powers. Yeah! We will fight their violations of our Constitution of the United States of America. Yeah! We will not shut up. We will stand up. Yeah! We will speak up. Yeah! We will rise up.
Earlier this week, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, was moved under the control of Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and almost all its employees put on leave, following an executive order from President Donald Trump freezing U.S. foreign assistance pending review. Jonathan Jackson is a Democratic congressman.
Now we're seeing the most powerful man in the world, Donald J. Trump, and we're seeing the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, now take money and food from the poorest woman and the poorest man on earth.
Congressional Republicans say Trump is exercising broad presidential authority to reevaluate government agencies. Trump is accomplishing this through Elon Musk, a multi-billionaire whom he put in charge of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, whose aim is to reduce federal spending. John Thune is Senate Majority Leader.
I don't think they're closing an agency, but I do think they have the right to review funding and how those decisions are made and what priorities are being funded. I think that's probably true of any administration when they come in. There are lots of programs authorized and funded through that agency, some of which I think are operating in the way in which they were intended and some which aren't.
One analyst told VOA the situation is unprecedented in the United States. Claire Finkelstein is a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania.
Arguably, it's a real violation of separation of powers for the executive branch to try to shut down agencies completely that Congress has brought into existence and that Congress endows and appropriates funds for. even if the executive branch has quite a lot of discretion with regard to how to operationalize those funds and how the agency is going to function.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Tuesday he's supportive of efforts to eliminate fraud and abuse, but criticized the speed and secrecy of the process.
Whatever DOGE is doing, it's not democracy. We know what democracy's like. It's out in the open. It's not secret.
Democrats have pledged to stall votes on Trump's cabinet nominees and leverage their votes on a new government spending bill to protest the changes at USAID. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Scott, lots to unpack here. And I think we've just learned a lot from Catherine's report about, you know, all the different facets of the agency and what Democrats and Republicans are fighting over.
And Lori, we're just learning as we put this show together that President Donald Trump's administration plans to keep fewer than 300 of the staff at the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, out of the agency's worldwide total of more than 10,000. Both Reuters and The Washington Post are reporting that. And the Associated Press says officials working with Elon Musk's Department of Global Efficiency wanted access to the Treasury Department's payment system to stop money from flowing into USAID. That, according to two people familiar with the matter, who on Thursday spoke to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity for fear of retaliation. Joining us for insights into the change in foreign aid policy is Michael O'Hanlon. He's a senior fellow with the 21st Century Defense Initiative and director of research for the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution.
First off, just thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
So, you know, there's been a lot of somewhat chaos and talk and conversation here and around the world about the United States halting all foreign aid assistance. And of course, the United States is by far the world's largest source of foreign assistance, and USAID, USAID, has been where most of that funding came from. We know a lot of people don't know the whole reasoning for it. I mean, there are varying views on, well, why are we giving our money to all these other people when we have problems here? But there's a thing called soft power diplomacy. And I wonder if you could just start with explaining to us what that is and why U.S. aid in particular and foreign aid plays a role in that.
Sure. I think it is correct to subdivide assistance into different categories. And you can talk about this soft power, if you will, as one of those categories. But it's worth first sort of delineating the other categories as well. And one of them is humanitarian aid, where you're trying to keep people alive, whether it's President George W. Bush's PEPFAR program for people with AIDS, whether it's children with childhood diseases that have often historically killed them, or mothers in childbirth who have died of the childbirth process, and trying to help them with basic medical care and clean instruments, you know, and to avoid infection. These are just some basic things we've been doing for decades, really in the name of humanitarianism. And I would hope that a president who, you know, has made a strong appeal to religious communities as part of his campaigning would recognize the ethical importance of those programs, even though they may not give us any soft or hard power per se, just be the right thing to do. So there's humanitarian aid. Of course, that also includes emergency aid for famines or for earthquake survivors or what have you. And then there are programs that are designed to foster economic development by helping countries build infrastructure or institutions or reform their laws to make it easier to own property, to encourage business formation. And that's a whole category of assistance that's usually, that, you know, the world has usually struggled to make those kinds of programs effective, but we have gotten better over the years. And it's always worth an occasional new debate on whether there's a better way to do it. And so a lot of us who may oppose the cutoff of aid that President Trump's instituted would acknowledge the value of fresh new debates on development assistance from time to time. And then a third category is probably more in the realm of hard power than soft power, and that is basically security assistance to our allies, some of whom we're just helping them defend themselves, but others of whom we consider that what they've done to defend themselves to be helpful for our own security. And for example, when Ukraine fends off Vladimir Putin, it makes it harder for Russia to threaten Western Europe and NATO countries. And so, you know, that kind of foreign assistance, I would put in the category of hard power, not soft power. And then finally, the soft power part, you know, what exactly does that mean? Part of it is you want the world to think of us as reliable, trustworthy, and generous in spirit. And so all those other categories of aid, can, even though their main purpose is other than soft power, they can contribute to soft power. But on top of that, there are programs that are explicitly designed to enhance our political standing around the world or to help our friends, you know, in a more more selective way. And that could be various kinds of, you know, international broadcasting. It could be support for countries that are close American friends, whether, you know, some development program or humanitarian need justifies it or not, just because we want to see those countries do better and we believe in them and they believe in us. But I really think that soft power, in a sense, is not a subcategory of foreign assistance so much as it is the overall impression that the United States creates around the world by the sum total of its assistance programs, its military partnerships, its behavior on the world stage, its dependability and crises for countries that might need our help. It's the basic image of the country. And again, there aren't really line items on the foreign assistance budget that are usually called soft power. There may be a few, but there aren't that many. It's more the sum total of everything we do. And so when you start to jeopardize that, countries start to say, you know, what's the real difference between Russia and the United States anyway, if they're both equally cynical about how they use their power around the world, and the United States is now arbitrarily cutting off aid programs that are meant to keep people alive, you know, that's going to change our image of the country and its basic motivations, its basic dependability as a friend. And so it's in that sense that I would define soft power.
And to be fair, there is in some of the things that we do in this regard a self-interest. If you can stop Ebola in Africa, it doesn't come to the United States.
Right.
But that having been said, there are things that were the Republicans have in their talking points a series of things that are highly questionable about that USAID was funding. And I think you briefly touched on it. It's not bad to look at what we're giving money to and, you know, determine as the time goes on whether it's viable or not.
Right. And I did a book when I arrived at Brookings 30 years ago, which, if you like, was sort of about 50 years into the modern era of development assistance. And I wrote this book with an economist who knew the economics better than I did. But we looked at the history of how the United States and other donors and the World Bank and other multilateral organizations, as well as private charities, how they had deployed money and resources over the previous half century, basically since World War II and the end of colonialism that more or less followed. And that was essentially the defining beginning era of major development assistance, roughly from the 1940s into the early 60s, when a lot of the original efforts were started and instituted and institutions were created to carry out this agenda. And so by the 1990s, we had several decades worth of experience. And you could look back and you could say, on average, the countries that have received more development assistance to build their economies have actually not done any better than the countries that received less. And that was partly because we just rewarded our friends, or we gave money to corrupt governments because at least they weren't communist during the Cold War, or because we, by giving them money for free, essentially from the outside, we made it less important for them to find their own resources, so they had less ownership of the project, or sometimes we gave them loans, which then just buried them with debt. There are a lot of reasons why in the early decades of modern development assistance efforts, things were not that successful, but they got better. And donors started to figure out, not so much because of anything we wrote at Brookings, but the overall movement of that period of time in the 80s, 90s, the general state of the art got better. And people started to give money more frequently to countries that were starting to show promise with good policy, and it needed to be encouraged and also needed to be given the resources to build infrastructure or otherwise turn those good policy ideas into reality and into economic growth. And so you started to see a better correlation between development aid and economic performance. But that was, you know, a modest step forward. And there's still a long ways to go in improving the way in which development dollars can promote economic growth. So it's always worth going back and doing reassessments of how well we're doing in the last 10 years to how well we had done before. And quite often the track record has not been as good as we would like. So that kind of reassessment, nobody's going to oppose. But, you know, why cut off all the dollars in the meantime when those dollars are saving lives and supporting ongoing programs, many of which are actually doing some modest good for the recipients?
Right. And you mentioned, you know, global media and a bunch of different humanitarian projects. And USAID also apparently supports democracy governance and promoting it in places that would, as you kind of mentioned, you alluded to as well. And my understanding, even media projects in countries where Russia exerts large influence. There are some concerns that we're hearing that cutting off all of this foreign aid actually can threaten global security, which would mean something that would be a part of our foreign policy.
Yeah, I think, you know, you folks mentioned earlier the example of a pandemic that you'd want to stop it wherever it arose, as close to its origin and as soon in its spread as possible. And if that was overseas, then that's a good place, you know, speaking selfishly, better than having it happen in Topeka, Kansas. And if we can keep it at the place where it started, it's to our own benefit as well. So there's, you know, it may be the right thing to do on ethical grounds. It's also the right thing to do for our own selfish well-being and national security. But there are other cases where there may not be quite as obvious of a correlation, and cases where you try to promote democracy or free media or what have you, and you fail because it turns out the president of that country was a dictator in waiting who wanted to lure us into providing a bunch of money that he could then direct to his own cronies. And, you know, we didn't know it at the time, or we hoped that some of them were good. Maybe the ones who were good, he winds up assassinating or putting in jail. And we've thrown a lot of money at a country in the interest of building democracy that winds up a dictatorship. That's happened plenty of times. Or what I saw on the ground, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Congo, which was then called Zaire, in the 1980s, and Mobutu Sese Seko was the president. He was anti-communist, so we liked him, but he was corrupt. He had palaces, big palaces, in every one of the country's provinces. He lavished money on his own friends to make sure they would never have coups against him. He favored his own ethnic tribe over others. He was just a bad dude, and a lot of American dollars went towards helping him, and sometimes we said it was in the interest of promoting economic growth, and we hoped for the best, but we sort of should have known better. So I'm not going to suggest that, you know, we should have sustained all those programs. Another example in more recent times, and I saw this with my own eyes as well in Afghanistan, when I went over on a lot of research trips during the height of the U.S. mission, we were trying to help build a democracy there. And Afghanistan didn't have much in the way of democratic traditions, but they had a lot of Afghans who had been educated in the West and went home after the Taliban was overthrown in 2001 and who tried to build this democracy. Everybody's intentions were good, except the Taliban's, and they wound up winning the war. And all this effort we had put in democracy promotion, I don't want to say it was all wasted because there are still good people in Afghanistan trying to do good things, but they're living under a tyranny. And so anything we tried to build really didn't translate into something that was durable. So when you get into this business, you're sort of playing the statistics. You're going to win some and lose some. And what you've got to do is make the smartest bets possible, but not expect to succeed every time. And that's why, to your question, I'll finish on this. When you know you've got a program that's working with a recipient that appears worthy, and you just cut the flow of resources off because of some policy review you're doing back home, it's sort of like you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. And why would you want to stop the good stuff before you figured out a review and a way that can, you know, identify the good from the bad and protect the good, enhance the good programs, and then maybe reduce the frequency and scale of the bad ones? That's the way you should do it, in my judgment, especially when lives are on the line, but also when democracy is on the line, when security is on the line, and when you realize that, again, these programs sometimes work, sometimes don't, but that's just because they're dealing with human beings in overseas countries where we don't control the decisions. All we can do is try to set up and improve the odds that democracy and human rights will be promoted, but we don't make the ultimate decisions in these places, so we're going to have some failures. But if you're, again, if you're having successes, why would you want to stop those arbitrarily just for a dispute you're having back in Washington?
There are people, we talked to one the other day, who think that the money should be cut permanently and all the entire budget of USAID should be spent elsewhere or not spent at all. They're on a mission to cut $1 trillion to $2 trillion out of the $7 trillion federal budget. So I just want to sort of summarize, I'm running a program or I'm a dependent in a program in Africa or in the Middle East, and the program gets cut off. You made the point early on. I just want to summarize it again. And I am aware that this money is coming from the United States, and I feel good about the United States because of it, and it gets shut down. What happens overseas to these people, the way they think about the world?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I know what you're saying, and I like to see our image promoted myself, but I wouldn't try to justify to an American taxpayer that they should give money overseas just to make people like us better as the main goal, because how countries feel about us is going to be dependent on so many other things as well, like we just discussed, you know, our broader foreign policy, our diplomacy, our image in the world, you know, Beyonce, Billie Eilish. I mean, there's just so many things that contribute to America's overall image. And the notion that a foreign aid program can make a big difference, you know, is maybe not the best reason to give hard-earned taxpayer dollars. So I like to justify the programs more on the earlier grounds that I identified, keeping people alive, helping them build their economies so they can be better economic partners with us, helping them improve their security so conflict around the world is less common and we don't have to go in with our own military and squelch it or resolve it. And then also the point you folks made about trying to prevent bad things like pandemics from spreading abroad in the interest of protecting our own country here at home, sort of with a front line of defense strategy. And all those things together, if you think in those, frankly, more selfish terms, many of those goals, except the first that I identified, are largely selfish, then I think the soft power follows. But I don't tend to go, as a supporter of foreign aid, but who's talked to a lot of skeptics of foreign aid, and a lot of taxpayers who have worked hard to make their income and sort of resent every dollar they have to give to Washington, I don't tend to lead with the argument about buying friends, because, again, it's so fickle anyway, and it may not be a lofty enough goal to justify people having to empty their own wallets. But first of all, the amount of foreign aid we give, of course, is tiny. You're talking about saving $1 trillion out of a $7 trillion budget. And, of course, all of foreign aid together is in the ballpark of $50 billion a year. So we're talking about 5% of that $1 trillion goal. And even if you eliminated every single dime, including the dimes that go to Israel and other friends of the United States that even Trump supporters typically don't want to abandon. So it's a modest amount of money. And for that modest amount of money, we keep a lot of people alive. We help countries improve their economies. We help countries improve their security. We identify and stymie things like pandemic disease early and nip them in the bud. And then as a fringe benefit of all that, we tend to find that people often like us better and see our soft power as even more impressive. But I would make that last argument a derivative or consequence of the others and focus on those.
Thank you so much for taking the time to explain all of this to us. Really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice talking with you both.
Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow with the 21st Century Defense Initiative and Director of Research for the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution.
I don't know about you, but I learned a lot from that interview.
It's interesting, some of the things that he said, and he made the point that people who want to keep some foreign aid funding in place, and as we heard at the very beginning of today's show, Secretary of State Rubio said that he was going to give another exemption. They have given some exemptions for funding to this point, and he's going to give another one today in the Dominican Republic for a program that they feel is worthwhile.
You've been listening to The Issue from the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
You can follow The Issue on X, Blue Sky, and Facebook at VOA The Issue. And for news 24/7, check out our website at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London. We'll talk to you tomorrow.